Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Today on your show, fixing our dysfunctional employment market and investing in better leaders, better teams, and better results. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at CareerCycles.com. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. What makes teams and leaders work together productively? Nicole Bendeley focuses on team and leadership development, communication, and facilitation, especially for new leaders. She's president of training company Connect. Their assessments and processes are used in over 200 healthcare organizations. Nicole is the co-author of Improving Healthcare Team Performance, the 7 Requirements for Excellence in Patient Care. Nicole started her career in marketing and banking before deciding to join forces with her mother, Leslie, at Connect. Leslie Bendeley also joins us this morning. Leslie's passion for team development and organizational change led her to found her own consulting company, Connect, where she unleashed her creativity with a team fitness test and other team development programs. Leslie's authored 10 books on team and leadership, including Games Teams Play and Leadership on the Run. Her models, tools, and books are used in organizations worldwide. Stay tuned for the daughter-mother career story in the second part of today's show. But first, with high youth underemployment and growing income inequality, what's causing our employment market in Canada to be dysfunctional? Is it inevitable? Is it competition from overseas? Is it the drive to make money at the expense of jobs? Policy researcher Tom Zizis joins us to zero in on the problem and some surprising solutions. Tom is Metcalf Innovation Fellow and has authored a recent report called Better Work: The Path to Good Jobs is Through Employers. He previously held senior positions in the government of Ontario, including Director of Policy, Premier's Office. He's taught at York and Ryerson Universities and has been involved in international development projects on civil society and poverty alleviation. Tom Zizis, welcome to Career Buzz.
Good morning, Mark.
Great to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
So what do you like about your career these days?
Well, it's challenging. It's intellectually challenging. There's a lot of variety. I work as a consultant, and so I have a number of different projects on the go at any one time. There's a certain amount of stress. There are deadlines, and there's always trying to find the next assignment. But overall, you get a fair amount of flexibility in terms of your how you organize your work, and certainly in terms of the subject matter that I'm engaged in. I you know, to tell you the truth, I'm probably a workaholic, so focusing on the labor market for me is a perfect fit.
And what are all the things you're up to? It sounds like you're an independent consultant, but I mentioned in the intro you're also doing something with Metcalf Foundation. Mm-hmm. What are all the things that you're doing?
Well, I'll work, for example, with community colleges or municipal governments to do analyses of local labor markets, trying to identify what are appropriate interventions in terms of training or linking up with employment services. I do studies for other groups looking at labor market information needs, for example, and sometimes I'll work outside of the labor market field doing evaluations, say, of different services and so on. And as you mentioned, I've done work overseas, which is a completely different kettle of fish.
This is a career or a workplace show, so it's always interesting to hear what skills or strengths people get to use in their work. What would you say the top few strengths or skills that you draw on to be successful?
Well, I suppose there's some technical skills that I rely upon. I do a fair bit of number crunching. So I take data, typically, say, from Statistics Canada, and I have to analyze it. So it's not just a matter of preparing tables and doing what you'd call a data dump, but actually trying to understand what's the narrative, what's the story. So you have to try and put that data in context. So on the one hand, it's working with equations and developing charts and tables. But on the other hand, it's trying to look at, well, what have been the trends over time? In terms of trying to understand it, you might look at other studies that others have done, whether it's in Canada or other jurisdictions, because we all have very similar labor markets. We're all feeling the same kinds of pressures. So it gives you a kind of a breadth of experience looking at what others have found, and it's like a puzzle for me. I really quite enjoy it.
So there's a lot to talk about with especially your recent study, Better Work, but before we get to what you're doing now, you've had an interesting career story with many twists and turns. I said in the intro you were working in the government of Ontario. What's one turning point, Tom, that you can share with listeners in your own career story?
I guess getting fired by the people of Ontario. I worked on political staff, right? So in addition to politicians who get elected, their staff are contract staff that were not civil servants. And so we're there depending on whether the party that we're working for is in power or not. And so I started in 1979. We were in opposition. And that was an interesting experience because you're learning by trying to criticize those who are in power. So you get a chance to try out different policies without being responsible for putting them into place.
Yes.
But then in 85 we formed the government, and that was a very exciting time. And we were reelected in 87, but in 1990 we were defeated. And so not only was David Peterson and his government defeated, but there's quite a large number of political staff, premier's office and minister's office staff, who also lose their jobs as a consequence. And I was one of them. And I thought at the time that I would spend a bit of, step back a bit and, determine what would be my next job, where else would I find a full-time job. And, people approached me, asked me to do a piece of research work, and then someone else asked me to teach. And after a while, I realized I could cobble together an income through all these short-term assignments. And I've been doing that now since 1990.
So that was the beginning of your kind of independent consulting work.
Yeah, and it wasn't by choice. I think at the time, if someone told me that I didn't know where my income was going to come from 6 months from now, that would have given me a panic attack. But it's funny how you kind of ease into it and actually get kind of adapt to that cycle of organizing your work.
It seems that adaptability, that was the word that was going through my mind, that so many workers today need both that sense of adaptability and an ability to be resilient when problems happen or you get fired by the people of Ontario.
Yeah.
You need to be able to bounce back, or as some people say, bounce forward from a setback.
Absolutely. Those are necessary skills and attributes. At the same time, I guess because I'm a labor market analyst, I'm sometimes a bit wary of suggesting that that's a lifestyle or a work style for everyone.
Yes.
And I think the movement towards more contract work, I think, is problematic in terms of our general economy, but also it's problematic for different individuals because not everyone has a personality suited to that kind of work style.
Absolutely. Even though many people are needing to draw on those personal qualities of adaptability and resilience in today's labor market.
Yeah, that's right.
My guest this morning is Tom Zizis. He's a policy researcher. He's fellow with the Metcalf Foundation. I'm Mark Franklin, host of Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide at CIUT.fm. So, Tom, the problems that are in our labor market, you've written a lot about it, you've been thinking a lot about it. One of the things that I've heard you speak about is this finding that Canada has the highest proportion of graduates of college and universities in the world, yet also we have the highest rate of degree holders working in jobs earning half the median income or less.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here? What's the problem?
Well, I guess the first point to make, and the reason why I cite that statistic, is that we've made a lot of noise about the knowledge economy and the importance of ensuring that you get higher levels of education, that people stay in school and that they strive for post-secondary degrees. And the first point I want to make with that statistic is to say that, you know, Canadians have answered the call, that it's not the case that somehow we should be investing even more in post-secondary education. The fact that we have large proportions of people with college and university degrees who are working in entry-level service jobs, not part-time but full-time. These are essentially the only jobs they've been able to access, I think points to a larger dysfunction. One of the things I look at is the fact that our labor market has changed substantially over the last 30 years. We had a system where typically an individual would work for one or two employers throughout their lifetime. People would get hired in entry-level jobs, they'd acquire experience and training in that position, and they'd advance up to occupations that required more skill. That's kind of broken down, and instead, employers, when they're looking for people for those higher level positions, are not necessarily looking within, or they're not grooming people having in mind where they might end up 2 or 3 years from now, but they're doing what we call just-in-time hiring. And as a result, these individuals aren't known to employers, and so they require credentials. They have to establish what their skills are in order for employers to know that they have the ability to do the job. That's why resumes have become so important, right? And so we spend so much time teaching people on job search skills and presenting themselves to employers. But what we've lost is that there's been less investment in the workforce in terms of developing talent within. Now, certainly at the high end, we do see, I know in a lot of firms, people are putting a lot of investment in their higher end staff and employees. But in terms of developing people from the entry-level position to middle-level positions, we see less of that.
Not happening as much.
Yeah. So the entry-level jobs that used to then lead to something else are more dead-end jobs than they were before. And then I think that's one of the problems that describe our labor market.
Especially with the younger generation, the millennials, you hear so much about, especially employers talking about their personal qualities that don't fit the workplace. There's been a lot of blame placed on the job seekers. And I think what we're hearing is maybe an encouraging message for them. It's not so much their fault. They've actually stepped up to what was needed, was getting that post-secondary education. And it's wrong to blame the job seekers.
Well,
that's what I think I'm hearing at this part of the story.
That's right. And so much of our policies have been focused on what we call the supply side. We're trying to fix those individuals who are looking for work, or we're encouraging them to acquire skills by staying in school longer. But what we spend far less time looking at the demand side and looking at how that has changed in terms of what opportunities are available to individuals. And so that's been, I guess if there's one message from a policy perspective that I really stress, is that we've got to pay far more attention to employers and adjusting some of their practices.
Right on. I want to get to some of the solutions, the demand side solutions that you talk about, but just understanding the problem a little bit more, you've said the employment market is a bit like a game of musical chairs, and someone is taking a chair out at every round, as if the chairs are those jobs. And you talk about the perspective of employers. You use this term financialization of the employment market, at least the companies that are employers. So what's going on? Why is it that employers are doing this just-in-time hiring that you've mentioned?
Well, you know, the transformation that took place around 30 years ago, there are many, many reasons. You alluded to some. We have increasing competition from overseas. We have the information technology revolution. We've had technological changes in terms of transportation that also allow for globalization of our economy. Certainly, I think the break in that social contract of permanent employment as I said, undermined those career ladders that used to exist. That taking place, employers then look at how they can contain costs, not simply because they might be at some disadvantage from a competitive point of view, but in some cases they're also being driven by what are the expectations of the stock market, what's going to be the return on the investment. And with finances being so mobile these days, money is always looking for its greatest return. And so there are various ways that employers can improve that return. They can either increase their productivity. They can invest in their workforce to produce a higher quality service or product. Or they can look at how they can cut costs. And one of those costs, one of the easiest costs to look at is on the labor side. So it's not only perhaps shedding workers, but it may be outsourcing them. It may be subcontracting them, putting people on more precarious employment terms that reduce the impact on the salary cost. Each individual business that's making that kind of determination may have a justification in terms of their bottom line. But the cumulative effect of all those businesses making those decisions actually harms our economy and harms those businesses because it dampens the consumer demand that otherwise would be there if people were earning an adequate salary.
That's the essential point that I was hoping you would make. I've heard you speak before, and it hit me that the collective benefit of everybody investing in training and everybody having a kind of job market and training, even if that person gets hired and leaves after 2 years, it's still a good thing because all those people who are the employees are also the market for the products and services.
Yeah, and so that's the argument for why we need public policies that support it, because the marketplace depends on individual decisions, but you can have all individuals making decisions that actually have a collective bad effect. And I think that's the function of government, to ensure that we influence those decisions to have a collective good effect.
Wow, well, you've picked a big problem to try and solve, Tom. That's a massive problem.
Well, it took us 30 years to get to this mess.
But I think at least we're starting to understand it. Like, what I appreciate about some of the things that I've heard you speak about is really trying to get at the root of what's going on here. And I think we're just starting to get at that. My guest today is Tom Zizis. He's a policy researcher, also a fellow with the Metcalf Foundation. You're listening to Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM, worldwide at CIUT.fm, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin. So a couple of things, Tom, you hear a lot talked about this so-called skills mismatch. Mm-hmm. And that's out there a lot in that phrase. And people are now questioning, is that really the case? And is it just a problem, really, with employers not helping people get those skills that are required or in some way dealing with that? So you've said Canada's skills mismatch is really a work experience mismatch. What did you mean by that?
Well, first of all, yes, this has been a topic now in the media for a couple of years. And there have been a number of studies that have come to the conclusion, and these are studies by the TD Bank, for example, and the Canadian Parliamentary Budget Office, that have said when we look at the data, particularly in terms of how wages are rising, what are the vacancy rates and so on, that actually skill shortages would appear to be relatively limited in terms of couple of geographic areas, especially out in Alberta, for example, and a couple of specific occupations, that by and large the evidence didn't appear to be there. On the other hand, we can't discount the fact that employers are regularly saying in surveys that they're having difficulty finding qualified workers. But when we probe that a bit deeper, what we find, it's less the technical skills that employers are complaining about, but far more what we call the soft skills, the understanding of that particular workplace, you know, the dynamic of interactions between with coworkers, with clients, with suppliers, knowing how to work with a team, being self-motivated and so on. And those, for me, are specifically those skills that you learn through working. The thinking that you can acquire those skills primarily through school, I think, is putting too much of a expectation on schools. It's like saying that you need to spend 4 weeks in the classroom before you can go into the pool to start learning how to swim. And I think there's a need to convince employers that, in fact, they have a role to play in terms of assisting individuals to make the transition into the workplace, that people cannot come to the workplace 100% fully formed. That's something you acquire over the course of a couple of years of work.
There are lots of solutions that people are talking about. I know you have a model that I wanna talk about in a moment. But the federal government itself has taken a stab with the Canada Job Grant. So it's an approach, and it's out there, and you see it on every government website, and you know the connection between the federal program and then each province has their version of it. How well or not well does that program address some of the problems that we're looking at?
Well, I think it's certainly a start. One of the issues that act as a barrier to training is cost. And so providing some financial incentive to employers to undertake training is certainly important. My beef with the Canada Job Grant is that the challenge we face is a bit bigger than only a cost consideration. Employers are concerned, for example, if they train someone, that individual might be poached by a competitor who's not prepared to make that investment. They may not know really what training is necessary. They may not know what's the appropriate certificate that is appropriate. If we want to ensure there is mobility, we want to make sure that certificate is recognized by other employers. What I'm getting at is that we also need to think about the broader labor market when it comes to that kind of training. We're not only looking at an individual employer. So we should be using those training programs to ensure that there are, again, some collective decisions being made here or partnerships, for example, among similar employers in the same industry so that we get some economies of scale in having this training take place so that employers don't have to worry about the competitor down the street poaching the employer because their employee because they're also engaged in that same training program. We want to encourage the building of relationships between employers and community colleges that will be sustainable over time whether there's a Canada Jobs Grant or not. And so I think we want to use the leverage of the opportunity of training dollars to also ensure there's some systemic change that brings a change in practices and a change in terms of the overall labor market.
Right. So in 5 minutes now, let's talk about how to solve this big problem that you've laid out for us. You talk about demand side solutions, by which I think you really mean it's the employers. It's not the supply side. It's not the job seekers. It's the employers. And you've talked about a kind of model that's going to make these stakeholders work together and play nice. There's a lot of different approaches to that, and you've got several levels of this model. It's hard to depict in a radio show. But what are a couple of pieces that we can look toward that are part of this larger picture solution that's going to make a healthy, strong labor market, which is at the center of your model?
Well, I describe it as, say, a three-level approach that, on the one hand, we need to address those barriers that individual employers face. So as we spoke before, the issue of cost, the concern about poaching, understanding that there is a return on investment in training. So it's you know, getting the knowledge out there, getting the best practice out there. That's one level. But the second level, as I said, is at a system level. We want to make sure we have those bodies that can work with employers to link them up with the training. That includes unions. That includes, in Ontario, workforce planning boards that can act to bring employers together and identify what kind of trainings they need and connect them with, for example, community colleges or universities. But I think the third level is that, to some extent, we haven't addressed some of the values or norms that are important in this area. You know, over the last 20 years or so, we've increasingly looked at wages and employees as a cost, as opposed to an investment. And I think there are things that government can do that can encourage the mentality around changing the culture in relation to training and in terms of in relation to investment in workforce development. So just for example, even the discussion around minimum wage obviously has, in my view, an important social benefit, but it's also an important signal in terms of what we value as a society, that individuals are recognized for the work that they do. I think it would be useful for us to even identify what we consider to be a good job and hold up standards celebrating employers who invest in their workforce, who provide paid internships. I think those lists of 100 best employers, I think, are something that should be given greater prominence. When governments contract out services to private firms, I think there should be a consideration for what kind of jobs those firms provide as part of the calculation in assessing which bid should be awarded the contract.
Lots of potential solutions to at the norms and values level. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how important this is. You talked about what a good job is, the Gallup organization, I know you've quoted them. You know, there was that book recently, The Coming Jobs War, as mm-hmm. if this is what really matters to people most. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a shift in what's important to people. And I think now that you're onto something with this and at the level of norms and values, so how can ordinary people get involved? If listeners are out there, like, you know, we're talking about government making procurement decisions, we're talking about opinion leaders saluting employers who care about people, but ordinary listeners and people, let's say the job seekers, the supply side people, what else can they do to be involved in this?
Well, I think it's a bit like the environment, you know, that we have, you know, you have to understand the bigger picture to encourage individuals to make good choices in terms of their own lives. And so partly it's stepping back and recognizing what has happened to our labor market. And as I said, that we shouldn't, an example I would give, we shouldn't begrudge people because, let's say, they have a union job and they get a higher level of wage. It's not that we want to bring people down to some lowest common denominator. I think we want to encourage everyone to rise up to that better job quality. And whether it's in a public job, public sector job, or private sector job, union job or non-union job, that we can support those kinds of initiatives, government policies or individual employers that encourage good jobs to happen.
The report you authored is available on the Metcalf Foundation site.
Yes.
I know there's a bunch of things. If you go to metcalffoundation.com, is that the best place for listeners to go if they want to find out more?
Yes, it is.
And there's two reports. I got a little lost. There was one from 2011, and then there's another from 2014.
Yeah, the first report is called Working Better, and the second report is called Better Work. So it's, I guess we're trying to make it sound like it's part of a series, but maybe it's a bit confusing.
Last question, Tom. It's been so interesting to hear your perspective on this from your own personal career story, and you told us right at the beginning about changes that happened in your career in 1990. What have you learned personally about making choices, making good choices in your own career and life that you can share with listeners?
Well, I have to say, in my case, a lot of it was almost by accident, and you know, as you pointed out, you know, having that flexibility and resilience and meeting opportunities as they arise. I don't think I could have planned this sort of career, and I don't think I would have wanted to, because it's been a really interesting journey.
Great, thanks, Tom Zissis, for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Pleasure.
And we'll have you come back at the very end of the interview. I know Leslie and Nicole, who we're going to speak to in a few minutes, were nodding vigorously as you were making some of the points about investing in training. So we're going to come right back with our second set of interviews right after this short break.
Considering studying abroad? Visit the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Sunday, March 1st at the Metro Toronto Convention Centre, North Building, to meet with top universities from around the world offering postgrad, undergrad, and diploma programs abroad. Visit the Travel Zone for volunteering, language programs, adventure travel, and work abroad. Expo opens at 1 p.m., but come early at 12 noon to catch our feature seminar. Admission is free. Check the website for more info. Studyandgoabroad.com.
CIUT 89.5 FM, in cooperation with Heart House U of T, presents A Conversation with Jesse Brown, Thursday, February the 12th at 3 p.m. Jesse Brown is the host of Canada Land, a podcast critiquing Canadian media and investigating Canadian culture. CIUT's The Green Majority host and producer Darren Kaster will moderate the conversation. You may listen to the live broadcast of A Conversation with Jesse Brown on CIUT from 3 to 4 p.m. on Thursday, February the 12th, or you may register to be a member of the studio audience at hearthouse.ca. A Conversation with Jesse Brown, Thursday, February the 12th, 3 p.m., and only on CIUT 89.5 FM, the new sound of your city.
And we're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on to our next interviews, I want to let listeners know about the inspiring podcasts of Career Buzz episodes. If you click the Career Buzz button at the right side of careercycles.com, you can hear some of the past shows. We had a really interesting show on January 7th. Lawyer-turned-novelist Kate Hilton joined us, and she talked about how to avoid being the career frog boiling in the water. She left her position after realizing that she was becoming so ingrained in a workplace reality, and it made all the difference in the world. So if you want to listen to her story and many others, check the Career Buzz button at careercycles.com. Nicole Bendeley focuses on team and leadership development, communication, and facilitation, especially for new leaders. She's president of training company Connect, whose assessments and instruments are being used in over 200 healthcare organizations across North America. Nicole is author or co-author of Improving Healthcare Team Performance, The 7 Requirements for Excellence in Patient Care. Nicole started her career in marketing and banking before deciding to join forces with her mother, Leslie, at Connect. Leslie Bendeley is also joining us here this morning. Leslie didn't know she was interested in learning until experiencing a CUSO gig as a teacher. Upon her return to Canada, she gravitated to learning and development roles in banking, public sector, and consulting, and her passion for team development and organizational change led her to found her own consulting company, where she was able to unleash her creativity. Her 10 books include Strengths in Numbers, Games Teams Play, and Leadership on the Run. Her models, tools, and books are used in organizations worldwide. Leslie's work is recognized in Who's Who in Canada, Who's Who in Canadian Business, and Who's Who of Canadian Women. Welcome to Career Buzz, Nicole and Leslie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Great to have you here. Great to have you on this show right after Tom's interview. I know there's a lot of common connections there. Nicole, what do you like about your career these days?
Oh, gosh. You know, there are so many things that I love about it, from being an entrepreneur to actually doing the work that we do around supporting teams and leaders. I think what I love most is the impact that we can have on a single individual that can have ripple effects across the organization as well. But it's that human connection and working, whether you're working with a group or working with somebody one-on-one, when you see the impact a conversation can have with them, or sharing a simple tool to make their work easier or their experience better on a daily basis, and see them using it, or just seeing a light bulb go off, and it can just be a simple conversation and helping somebody see a situation differently. I think that's what I love most about what I do, and the relationships and the connections with people that we get to build, and seeing the impact of those, just from an individual perspective, most importantly, but also the impact that it has on the organization when we see it over time as well. So I think that's what I love most. And then I can go on about, you know, from an entrepreneurial perspective, how much fun that can be as well. But it's,
well, you are doing a lot. You're doing the training and facilitation, and you're also running a consulting company. What would you say are the top few skills that you draw on regularly to be successful?
I think it's like I said, it's the building of the relationships and really connecting. and engaging with people. I love listening to people's stories like you do, Mark, right? And really understanding what they need, what's working and what's not. And so it's building those relationships and the communication that goes along with that. I think, too, another aspect is that resilience piece. And that's something that I've had to build, you know, and work at over, gosh, the, you know, 10, 12 years that being an independent consultant and leading a business is being able to take risks and being able to fall forward or fail forward, right? And learning from that. There have been a lot of bumps in the road, but to be able to not take things so personally and not be too scared to try again and be okay with failing, I think that's a key skill as well. That is continuing to be built, but is important.
Well, we'll find out about that and the dynamic of working in a daughter-mother business in a moment. Leslie Bendeley, what about you? What do you like about what's happening these days in your career?
I think most exciting is seeing the reward. And that by that, I mean the reward in seeing change within an organization. So I guess basically what Nicole was describing is also what's always motivated me. But I'm also, I didn't realize it until I started the business, actually, but I do have an entrepreneurial spirit. So it's also fun with business development and marketing and seeing opportunities out there. So there's a nice balance between growing our company and seeing other people's companies grow.
Now, how are you still involved in the consulting company?
Well, as you may know, I live part-time out of the country because my husband's posted in the Caribbean. So what I'm doing here in the winter, I'm not sure. But anyway, what I do now more is looking at development and writing and sort of the backup part of it. Nicole's become more of the face of the company and does more of the direct interface with the clients, although I still do some work with clients. But mostly I spend my time writing, researching, and developing new programs and new products for us, new services.
Right. So it sounds like there's a kind of nice balance. You look like the writer and the developer with all of the stuff that you've developed. Is there a nice kind of complementarity to the skill set that the two of you bring?
There actually is. And I'm not suggesting Nicole doesn't do any development either, because she does. You know, she writes and develops as well. But I've taken the lead on that. But there is complementary skills, I think. Nicole is more detail-oriented than I am, which has been a great benefit. I'm a little bit more, I call it big picture, but maybe it's a little bit off into the blue sometimes. And I think because of my writing experience, I'm a pretty good editor. And we could go through a whole long list, I think, of various qualities we bring. But I think the main thing for the two of us is that we actually get along together.
Well, we'll
at least I think we do. From family, my perspective, we get along
well,
together.
So interesting about family businesses. Let's get to that question in a moment. Just to hear how you got here. I said in the intro, Nicole, you started your career. You were doing marketing and in banking. What's a couple of the key turning points that brought you to the present moment?
Yeah, interesting. You know, the key turning point for me was, you know, I liked my job in banking. I love marketing, and that's part of the reason why I love running a business too, because there's marketing components to it. And I was a marketing manager for a large Canadian financial institution. But it came a point where I went from being challenged and loving it to liking it to, you know, not being too excited about going to work the next day and becoming a little bit bored. And I'm somebody that thrives on change and variety. And I found myself more, you know, getting juiced up about supporting my team and working with, you know, my team members and figuring out what it is they need and how we could be better. And so I asked myself, do I want my boss's job? No. Do I want my boss's boss's job? No. Then what am I doing here? And I was fortunate to have that sort of realization earlier on in my career, and was comfortable taking risks. I may not have had, you know, I didn't have a mortgage at the time and didn't have all of these other things that could be barriers to taking risks, to stepping into the unknown, as Tom said, you know, not knowing, you know, 6 months out where that next paycheck may be coming from. But I realized that I needed to be doing something different, that I wasn't meant to be there.
I just want to emphasize that kind of a test that you said, right? And I've heard this before with a number of other interviews. And for listeners who are trying to figure out, let's say they're feeling bored, I think you used the word, or disengaged, You know, and this test that you said a moment ago, I looked at my boss's job and I looked at my boss's job. And if you really say to yourself, I'm not interested, right? As right. you're telling us. So what can you tell listeners, Nicole, if they are doing exactly what you did some years ago and they see those two jobs and they say, what now?
You know, and do a bit of a litmus test. Okay, so what is it that I love about my job? And not just the skills that you're applying and the actual what you're doing, but the environment. What do you love about it? And what's missing? And if you could do anything in the world, what would it be? Realistically, right? I mean, I'm not going to suddenly become an astronaut. I might want to go to the moon, but I that's not going to happen for me. And then is there anything else? Is there anywhere else within the organization that you could go that may give you that, right? Or are there any other organizations? So just ask the question, right? We spend so many hours of our days with our heads down and just doing, and we don't often give ourselves the gift of asking the questions of what could I be doing differently, or is there other opportunities out there that may be best suited towards
internal
me.
First, internal right? I heard you first. Say, and we can have career conversations with our bosses or managers, and they should be open to that.
Right.
What can I do in here before I blast off into another organization or join my mother in her family business, as the case may be?
Right.
My guests this morning are Leslie and Nicole Bendeley of Connect. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM and worldwide at CIUT.FM. Over to you, Leslie. You're developing all kinds of great stuff. You've now got this interesting career where you spend half your time in Canada in the winter, although we don't know why that happens. what's one turning point that you can share with listeners in your career story?
I think my career story started with the revelation, because before I think it was a job story. It wasn't a career story. I was working with a larger consulting firm at the time, and through that experience, a couple of things happened. First of all, I recognized my strengths, which I think relates to what Nicole was just talking about. We often talk about doing what you're passionate about, which is a wonderful thing to say, but often we don't get a chance to do what we're passionate about. But we can play to our strengths. So I think what struck me there was I recognized my three strengths. I knew that I spoke well. I knew that I facilitated well. I knew that I wrote well. And what a revelation and what a relief, because often you're taking jobs and you think, well, I think I can do this job, but maybe 50 or 60% of it, you really aren't playing to your strengths and therefore you're not happy. And so I think at that point I recognized that. And the other thing that came to mind was I recognized my entrepreneurial spirit. You know, I looked around the consulting firm and thought, I could be doing this and I could be doing it as effectively as they're doing it. So why aren't I? And so that really spurred me on as well. So that was the turning point for me. And career-wise for other people, I think that's the key thing to think about, as opposed to what do I really want to do with my life? What am I passionate about? For example, I'm passionate about writing mystery novels, and I do write mystery novels, but it's not my career. But it doesn't mean I can't still do that and love that. But for my career, I found things where my strengths were. And once you start using your strengths, they become your passion. Because you start getting more successful and you see you're making a contribution and you're seeing the results, and suddenly you are passionate about those strengths that you didn't even realize you had a passion for
it before. Yeah, it becomes. I had another guest on the show who is a leading researcher on passion, Bob Vallerand. He was the president of the Canadian Positive Psychology Association, and he talks about your passions. First, they're kind of like an interest. You know, he gives the example, I play basketball, I like basketball, I'm passionate about basketball. But then finally he says, I am a basketball player. I am. And then the identity shifts and you start to say to yourself, I am. I am a writer. I am a speaker. And when you do that, a whole bunch of things follow because your identity is now connected to it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
You've written so many books. I just want to give listeners a heads up that you've brought one book to share with listeners. So there is a book giveaway in today's show. Do you want to just let listeners know what you've brought to share?
Yes, we brought along On Track, Taking Meetings from Good to Great. But this can be used if you're in an organization or if you're not working at the present time, if you're a volunteer somewhere, or you know, you're part of a gym and once in a while they get together and you want to facilitate something. It's basically how to get a group to work together and come to some kind of a decision.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing the book. If listeners want to call in with a comment or a question about today's show, please give us a call and you can win the book. The phone number is 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. Give us a call. And if you have a comment or a question, love to have you on the air. So before we get into kind of investing in training, which I want to get to build on our earlier interview, we need to talk about what it's like to work together in a mother-daughter business. So first of all, Leslie, at a certain point in time, Nicole said to you, gee, Mom, I'm interested in joining the business. What was your reaction?
Well, first of all, I was shocked. I can still picture it, that I was sitting at my desk and I got the phone call and we chatted a little bit and then Nicole said, Mom, I've got an idea. And she was a little bit hesitant and said, what would you think if I worked with you? And I thought, my daughter wants to work with me? You know, so I was quite excited about it. I don't think we spent a lot of time thinking about it. We're both rather spontaneous people. I think I just said, great idea. And Nicole said, great. And away we went. But I do think that instinctively and intuitively, we both knew we could work together. And I think that's very important in a family business, to think about that beforehand.
There's so many family business stories you hear where the parent wants the child, the son or the daughter, to join the business. Was that a desire of yours, or was it, you sound like you were shocked and surprised?
Well, I'd never thought of it before, because she had a good career path where she was and seemed to be enjoying it, and I knew she was doing very well. So it just didn't occur to me that would happen. But sometimes, yes, some people, sometimes the elder is trying to get young people to come in and they're not willing. But also I think sometimes the elder doesn't think through whether or not they can let go, because that's the biggest thing.
Yes.
That you have to be able to let go. And fortunately, my makeup doesn't make it too difficult. And Nicole,
I have the problem.
Wait a second, I'm seeing her reaction to that.
She's more of a controller than I am. So of course, if there's something I really feel, you know, no, this isn't going to work, you know, we come to consensus on it. But I'm quite happy. She knows what she's doing. Go for it, Nicole. Whereas I know that isn't easy for everyone.
Yes. And Nicole, leading up to that moment, you know, it sounds like you did have an interesting career story. Things were happening for you. What was that, like, that lead up moment before you made contact and said, Mom, let's join forces?
You know, as Leslie said, we tend to be quite spontaneous. You know, I went to, what, 3 different high schools. I went to 2 different universities. It's in my nature to change. It's just who I am, and I thrive on that. And so one of my weaknesses is probably I don't think things through maybe sometimes as much as I should. And in this instance, it was to my benefit. It was more of an instinct. I knew that I had, you know, a great career that I could likely go back to in a couple of years if this didn't work. I really didn't give much thought to it. And I wasn't nervous about it. And, you know, Leslie is so open and flexible that I knew she'd give me a shot.
Come on. You guys are making it sound so effortless.
It really was. And it's not, honestly, it's we have this relationship that's, I think, can be unique in that it's a strongly intuitive relationship where we just let each other go and do our thing and we come back and check in, and but we know that the other can run with things and
so any tips to listeners who might be considering joining a family business fraught with all kinds of potential problems? You hear lots more problem stories than these kind of positive stories. What's one or two tips that you can give to listeners?
Yeah, I would suggest making sure that you sit down before you even decide for sure to join forces and really talk about the potential downsides. And what about our personalities? Dad or Mom, can you handle it if I do this? All right, son or daughter, can you handle it if I do this? And really have some working agreements. And you're not going to have them written on the wall, but you're going to have talked it through and thought about it. And I think through that process, some people would go away and say, you know, I'm not sure this is a good idea. You know, love you as a mom or a dad or vice versa, but I'm not sure that it's going to work together. But on the other hand, if you do have that, you'll know what obstacles that potentially could be, and you're more prepared to deal with them. Plus, you're able to then say, well, remember when we sat down before we started, we talked about this, and we said it could be an obstacle. So how are we going to get beyond this one? Because I do think the personalities are the biggest piece.
Yes.
In a family business, because when you're in a corporate environment or a less formal environment, because a family business has become quite personal, you tend to restrain yourself. But I think in a family business, a lot of people, you know, the old buttons get pushed from past experiences, whatever.
I think the second piece to that absolutely are those agreements, and then it's the role clarity and clarifying, you know, who's playing what role and how are decisions going to be made, and managing one another's expectations up front. So to Leslie's point is developing those agreements around how will we make decisions, and who's responsible for what, and ensuring that that's clear up front, as well as, okay, well, how are we going to build this business together and where will your role be, you know, 2 years down the road, and when will we revisit sort of that succession plan. Succession planning is key, and is probably the most difficult piece in a family business that often gets overlooked from a very formalized process. So I think that's key as well, as that succession planning.
I think we can have a whole other radio show just on that one topic, but I want to save a few minutes to move forward into the whole world of training and investment. My guests today are Leslie and Nicole Bendeley of Connect. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM and CIUT.FM. We do have Leslie Bendeley's book On Track, Taking Meetings from Good to Great. Join us with a comment or question here on Career Buzz. Give us a call at 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. So just drawing on the conversation I had with Tom Zizis earlier in today's interviews, we were talking about the reluctance of Canadian employers to invest in training, especially, you know, early career people. What are you finding right now in your business about the willingness of Canadian or Ontario-based employers to invest in training?
They're not investing nearly as much as we would like to see them invest, not simply from our business point of view, but from the issues that that Tom's been talking about. It's definitely a concern today because over the last, as Tom said, 30 years, companies have become more and more bottom-line oriented. But I do believe the HR department within companies could take a different approach, which would help them. When someone is making a financial decision, the people at the top who are looking at their budgets and they decide how much is going to training, how much is going somewhere else, they're obviously looking at return on investment. So, for example, you can spend millions of dollars on the Super Bowl ad and you get all kinds of data back and you know exactly what your return on investment was. HR really needs to spend more time looking at how they can measure the results of their services, their programs, and so on. And that can be done with ease. So we really believe that the only thing that determines the effectiveness of a session is not the halo effect. People go out and say, oh, this is wonderful, I loved it. But what happens when they get back? And so we tie into all of our programs measurable measuring processes, which allow them over the next few months to really measure what were the results. That then can go to senior management and say, this is making a difference. Here's customer service has gone up, this has gone up, and therefore you're going to get more investment than you did in the past. There'll still be an issue because of the contract employees and all kinds of other things. But that's key.
So it's making a business case for training.
Make a business case for training, and you can so easily, but it takes a little bit of thought. In the past, it's been, you've all experienced, you fill out a little feedback form at the end of the session. Did you like it? And yes, everyone liked it. Well, that was nice, but what did they then go back and do with it?
Are you noticing any changes? We went through a recession some years ago, and now the recovery. You know, from the longer view that you've had, Leslie, have you noticed a bounce back effect more recently after the recession?
No, I think companies are still hesitant about the future. I think the economy just isn't stable enough, so they're banking their reserves rather than investing them in their people. Now, that's a generalization. I mean, there are some companies who are investing and doing great things, but the majority are much more conservative than they used to be.
They should all read Tom's report.
Absolutely.
And get on
absolutely
the better track.
Yeah.
Some of the training that you provide is about teamwork, and I just want to focus on one aspect of it. I was quite interested to see the seven characteristics of teams, something like that. And you go on to list them. And one of them I find really fascinating, and it's a theme here at Career Buzz, is innovation. Nicole, of those seven criteria or seven characteristics, can you say a little bit about what that means? What is that winning characteristic of a team that is innovation?
So, you know, we asked the question in our research around teams around what's the difference between teams that can excel at a very high level with relative ease versus those that struggle to keep up. And so that's where those seven characteristics came from. And that one element of innovation isn't about coming up with the next tablet or phone to rival Apple. It's about our teams challenging the status quo, asking questions of one another every day, you know, proactively sharing ideas and looking for little things, new and better ways of working together, new and better ways of getting the work done. It's about tapping individual creativity, right? So it's moving from the leader being at the center of the circle, providing solutions, to the leader simply asking more questions and saying, what do you think? You know, and having coaching conversations like you know so well, Mark, and enabling team members to have those same types of conversations. So innovation is really about challenging the status quo, challenging assumptions, being comfortable with failing forward and trying new things and taking risks. And that goes hand in hand with some of the other elements around change compatibility, which is key to exceptional teamwork, and being open to change, regardless of whether we agree with it or not, but we'll come together to make it work, right? That's part of making sure that we can be innovative, is being open to change. But the other element that is really the foundation of a high-performance team is that climate, right? And Tom spoke to this a little bit about the soft skills. Without providing opportunity to build the softer skills around how we communicate and relate to one another and engage with one another and respect and treat one another and at the workplace and create that positive experience, which creates that healthy climate, we will not be able to innovate. We won't manage change. We won't be able to have productive meetings. We won't be productive. And we will see high turnover, right? So investing in those soft skills, investing in training will reduce turnover, will create healthier work environments and build those strong relationships where people will want to stay and want to do the very best that they can.
A compelling argument that you've just made. And I think we're all nodding here. I think your point, Leslie, also about showing that it works, right? And making the business case. And I think that's going to make a bigger difference. And it's going to start to shift the mindset of employers and see that it's worth it. We're almost out of time here. If people want to find out more, Leslie and Nicole, how do they do that?
Our website to connect, KINECT.com or teamfitnesstool.com.
Thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz. I really appreciate the perspective that you brought.
Our pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations here on CI.